University of Pennsylvania. They want to alert the public about the government's fiscal policies, which they say are becoming unsustainable. They warn that ignoring the problem could have disastrous consequences for future generations. And they say that while there are no easy solutions, there are things that can be done. And that's what we're going to talk about today on Radio Times. And let me introduce our three guests. Robert Bixby is the executive director of the Concord Coalition, which is a nonpartisan grassroots organization dedicated to fiscal responsibility. And Robert Bixby, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Good morning.
Alice Rivlin is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. She was the first director of the Congressional Budget Office, also director of the Office and Management and Budget under the Clinton administration, and was vice chair of the Federal Reserve Board. And Alice Rivlin, nice to have you with us as well. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Stuart Butler, our third guest, vice president for domestic and economic policy studies at the Heritage Foundation. He's also an adjunct professor in public policy at Georgetown University. And Stuart Butler, nice to have you with us as well. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Let me start with you, if I could. I'll do this with you, Alice Rivlin, because here we are talking with you about fiscal responsibility and the country's fiscal policies at a time when we are trying to bail out the country's financial system and investing, at least at this point, some $700 or more billion dollars to try to rescue this particular system. Is there a disconnect here between what this tour is about and what the government is doing?
I don't think so. We have been concerned about the long-run health of the federal budget and therefore of the economy. That's a serious problem, and we've been going around the country trying to wake people up to the fact that our government has made promises under Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid that will become very expensive in the next few years and outrun tax revenues that could possibly be collected under anybody's ideal tax system. Now, we suddenly find ourselves in the middle of this financial meltdown, right. And the government is having to step in and restore order in the financial markets. That will cost something, but it won't cost as much as the cost of not doing it. We have no choice. We really have to get financial markets functioning again, or the economy will be in terrible shape.
So it's dealing with a short-term, or hopefully a short-term problem, and the long-term concern involves something even beyond what the government is doing today.
Right, but my hope is that the short-run crisis will wake people up to thinking about the government's finances in general. How do we pay for what we want the government to do? At the moment, we're not doing that.
Mm. And just a question, I'll put this to you, Stuart Butler, because in order to do this bailout, the cost of $700, and then I think they added about $150 billion worth of sweeteners to this bailout package.
Right.
That's money we have to borrow, right?
Well, yes. I think the worry is that, I mean, and just to pick up on what Alice said, yes, this is a short-term issue. We hope, of course, it's a short-term issue. But in answer to her, as you said, this may wake people up about what to do. Let's realize what they are doing. There's talk now of reducing taxes, increasing spending, and borrowing more money.
Exactly.
This is very worrying for those of us who are looking at the long-term situation, because the $700 billion you mentioned as a guesstimate for the initial part of this, if you look at the long-term obligations of the federal government that we're concerned with, the Medicare program, which is structurally out of balance, as is Social Security, as is Medicare, in the sense that our commitments well exceed what revenue we can expect going into those programs. Medicare alone, the potential exposure to the taxpayer is 50 times the level of the bailout for the financial system we've just enacted, at great pain and angst and, you know, gnashing of teeth and so on. That just gives you a sense of what the scale is of the future we're talking about. And that's why we're going around saying, you haven't seen anything yet compared with what with the structural commitments that we've made. And there are a lot of lessons, I think, from the current situation about what we need to do to avoid this huge future obligation coming due on our children and grandchildren.
Well, let me pick up on that. I'll put this to you, Robert Bixby, because I began the show saying, you know, that the government debt is something like $10 trillion. But as Stuart Butler just said, the liabilities that the country faces is more like $53 trillion. I should say $10 trillion versus $53 trillion.
Yeah, if you look at the long-term commitments for programs like Social Security and Medicare, and think about what is due under current law versus what is likely to come in under the payroll taxes and dedicated revenue sources, it has a net present value right now of $53 trillion. So really, we have a very large – we have a big problem in the short term, but we have an even bigger problem over the long term, which makes it even more important to maintain some fiscal discipline as we respond to the short-term crisis. We don't want to make the long-term problem worse.
Well, could we become Zimbabwe, Alice Rivlin? I mean, we are the world's debtor nation. Is that correct?
We are. We're also the world's largest economy. Right. Don't forget that. We are not Zimbabwe. We are a very productive, strong economy. We have some problems in the sense that we've been talking about, that our government has made promises that we won't be able to keep unless we change course. And there are course changes that we can take. But no, I think it's fallacious to say we could be a third world country, we could be Zimbabwe. We are much more productive and able to control our destiny than a third world country like Zimbabwe.
But when you hear about $53 trillion, Stuart Butler, of liabilities, of long-term liabilities, that does raise questions about raising taxes, cutting spending, more borrowing, I guess growing the economy. Mm-hmm. What are the various choices that face the country?
There are, of course, multiple choices. I come from Europe, as you can tell, and in the 60s and 70s and the 80s, the European governments and people in Europe pursued one course, which is a course of higher taxes and higher spending and larger welfare, a welfare state, and so on. And that is a respectable course of action. There are other ways one could go as well. Right. But the problem I think that we all agree on here is that right now there isn't a conscious decision-making about what that future should be. And that's why we and others have got together, for example, and said there's some very simple things to do right now. The first is to actually tell people about what the future situation is. We're trying to do that at a modest level going around. It would be very nice if the federal government, when it released its budget, for example, actually said, we have, in very explicit terms, this is what the long-run picture is of the course we are now on. Do you like this course, or should there be some other course? I think related to that, it's very important that that politicians should be forced to lay out in very clear terms, not what they want to do just in the next year or 5 years, but over the next 20 and 30 years. Where should we be going? Because I think that then determines the shape of what you do in the short term. And the fact is the political process right now does not require this. All it requires politicians to do at most is to say, this is what the picture will look like for the next 5 years. After that, well, we're not actually going to discuss that with you right now. We don't have to do that, and so we won't. They've got to be made to do that. There would be a very different discussion about taxes and spending and deficits if people really knew what the picture was and were forced to make decisions.
Well, let me just pick up on that. I'll toss this to you, Robert Bixby, because as we all know, we're in the middle of a presidential campaign, a very heated presidential campaign, and we hear the candidates talking to the American people about cutting their taxes and the various things that they want to spend money on, government programs on. This seems like not the right time to ask people, and voters, it seems, in this country don't like to hear about raising taxes, to ask people to live more within their means, or ask the country to.
I think it's important for the presidential candidates to acknowledge the size of the problem that we have and acknowledge that there are trade-offs that are going to have to be made, and talk about why it's important to act on these issues sooner rather than later. The government itself is changing its emphasis and focus on how we deal with the short term week by week as the situation changes rapidly. So it's probably unrealistic to expect the presidential candidates to have some sort of a 10-point plan to fix the short term crisis here. I don't think it's unrealistic to ask them to address and acknowledge the fact that we have this unsustainable problem in the long term. And really, that isn't something that either candidate has really talked about and dealt with. And I think part of the problem is that we think about deficits in a traditional sense. Deficits have been caused by a slow economy and by war. Those factors are at play now. The problem that we're talking about is an unprecedented problem, which is these entitlement commitments that have been made, excuse me, laid against an aging society.
Right.
So this is something new, and we have to think of it differently as sort of a cyclical deficit that comes and goes. This one comes and gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
And just picking up on that, go ahead, Alice Rivlin, you want to add something.
I think that's right. It's difficult to know how to talk about this longer-run crisis. When you use a number like $53 trillion, that's a big gee-whiz number.
I don't even know what that means.
None of us know what that means. None of us have a concept of $53 trillion. A better approach, I think, and this works with people, ordinary people, is to sit down and say, okay, let's take Social Security, for example. We have some choices. We could raise the tax, or we could raise the retirement age in the future so the people don't get it as soon, which makes some sense, but everybody's living longer. Or we could fix it so the benefits go to people who need it most. These things are controversial, but they're things people can actually think about as solutions, where it's very hard to think about $53
trillion. Right, but you're taking those solutions, though, would help the solvency of the Social Security program.
Oh, absolutely. And the point is that you don't have to make very big changes to solve the problem, but you do have to make something.
But you do have to. Go ahead, Stuart Butler. You want to add something?
Yes, I was just going to say, one way I think that we found to explain these large numbers to people is to break it down, to say, what's your share or what's your household share? This $53 trillion works out at about $175,000 per person. So really what you can say to people, I think, is that you've got this essentially credit card bill of $175,000. You don't actually have to pay it off. Nobody's going to make you do that. You can keep financing it and so on. Or you can give it to your kids and say, you figure out what to do. Or you could do some combination of all of the above and so on. I think in those terms, one can get people to think about the kinds of options. If you were to try to pay this down, how would you do that? What if you were to pass it off? What does that mean to say, to give your child or your grandchild, well, here's, it's yours. You figure out what to do, which is really what we've been doing. And I think when we go and talk to general audiences and point that out to them, I think baby boomers like myself and older are uncomfortable about the notion that we've built up this huge obligation and just simply are doing nothing right now. And so we do have to look at these options.
Well, and just to, as you said, this is something that future generations are going to have to deal with if it isn't dealt with more seriously.
Well, that's right.
Now.
And I think when you posit that to people, they say, well, we ought to be looking at both the obligations themselves and see if we can bring those down, and then also, you know, who pays for this and over what time.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with members of the Fiscal Wake Up Tour. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Philadelphia Orchestra, performing Berlioz's Romeo and Juliet, October 16th through 21st, under the baton of Chief Conductor and Artistic Advisor Charles Dutoit. Berlioz recreates on a musical canvas the core elements of this classic tragedy. For tickets and information, 215-893-1999 or online at philorch.org.
The next president will inherit a troubled economy.
We've had policies that have shredded consumer protections.
We are never going to let these kinds of abuses go uncorrected.
Tune in as John McCain and Barack Obama debate the woes of Wall Street. I'm Linda Wertheimer. Join me on October 15th for special coverage of the 2008 presidential debates from NPR News.
Tomorrow night at 9 on 91FM and WHYY.org.
On the next Fresh Air, how the National Security Agency has turned up the volume on Americans. We talk with James Bamford about his new book, The Shadow Factory, the ultra-secret NSA from 9/11 to the eavesdropping on America. It's his third book about the NSA. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
The This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. And while much of the country is focusing on the $700 billion bailout of the country's financial system, members of the Fiscal Wake Up Tour are reminding us about this national debt. And we have three members of the tour joining us today on Radio Times: Robert Bixby, Executive Director of the Concord Coalition; Alice Rivlin, a Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution; and Stuart Butler, Vice President for Domestic and Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Robert Bixby, just to help our listeners understand the scale of what you're talking about, and you mentioned Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. That's about, what, 40% of the budget? And these are entitlements. These are programs.
Those three programs alone comprise 42% of the federal budget. Now, of course, the boomers have not yet begun to retire. So there are already a large part of what we do at the federal level, and those programs are growing on autopilot, which means Congress doesn't go through each year and just determine how much we're going to pay. It's done by formulas and eligibility rules and that sort of thing. So that's really the concern when you look out over the long term of the federal budget. Is you got your three big programs that are growing faster than the economy, which can't go on forever.
But people, I think part of entitlement programs feel entitled. I mean, they feel that this is what they have depended on. This is what they have banked their retirement on, for instance.
Well, I think you have a fundamental choice of either paying all of those promised benefits and raising taxes considerably to pay for them, or scaling back the promised benefits in order to keep taxes from going, because you can't keep running budget deficits that would get too big and overwhelm the economy.
Go ahead, Alice.
That's right. But I think it's important to distinguish the medical programs, Medicare and Medicaid, from Social Security. Social Security is a problem in terms of its long-term funding, but it's not a very big problem. Over the next couple of decades, Social Security spending will rise from 4% of the GDP, the gross domestic product, to about 6%. Now, that's a big increase, but it's not off the charts. And then it kind of levels out because the baby boomers have passed through the system. We need to put Social Security on a firm foundation, but it's not very hard to do that. The really hard part are the medical programs, because they're a product of not only the aging of the population, but much more important, the rising per capita spending on medical care, which is a national phenomenon. It shows up in the federal budget in those two programs, right, but it's happening everywhere. It's hitting people of all ages, no matter how they're medical care is financed.
Well, I wonder to you, Stuart Butler, whether, you know, some kind of nationalized health care program, and if we had a health care program that was more perhaps like some of the European models, whether that would rein in costs for health care, whether we're talking about Medicare or Medicaid or even the larger.
Mm-hmm. Well, I lived under a system like that in Britain for 30 years. I'm not sure I'd wish it on anybody.
But
it's very important to understand the differences between, say, what Britain does and what this country does. And let me just give that as an example. In both the United States and in Britain, particularly the United States for the elderly, there is an entitlement to health care. In both countries, they promise all kinds of services and so on. The difference is this. In Britain, there is a budget for healthcare in the National Health Service. Parliament votes on a budget. It is a constraint. They have to make decisions. So, yes, you're entitled to healthcare, but not necessarily everything and not necessarily exactly when you want it and so on. In this country, you basically say, you're entitled to healthcare. Go out and get it. Send the bill to the government, and we'll pay for most of it. It's like having an unlimited check card and giving it to your teenager and say, go get what you need, and it'll come out of our account, and then pretending that you have like a budget for this, because you don't. You just have a guesstimate, which is what we do. There's no Medicare budget in the sense that there's a budget for the National Health Service. In America, we just guess what all the number's going to be and project it. That's what we actually do. So one way forward would be to say, let's actually put a real budget on Medicare. That means that one way or the other, then, you have to start making some decisions. You have to say, well, maybe Warren Buffett shouldn't get 75% of every prescription paid for. Maybe he should get none of that paid for by the rest of us. Maybe we ought to look at eligibility. Maybe we ought to look at other things. Maybe we ought to charge people more for their Medicare Part B premiums if they can afford it. We'd have to make some decisions like that, but that's never going to happen, in my view.
Why not?
Unless there is a fixed budget in some way, because think of any politician trying to say this. That's why they won't do it. So politicians actually have an enlightened self-interest to support some kind of fixed budget, because that in itself will make decisions happen. And I think that's one of the secrets to dealing with the American system, to dealing with the budget process itself, the way we set budgets and so on, because that in a sense, paradoxically gives politicians protection to do tough things.
Well, it seems like we are a country that only deals with problems when we have to, when we're, hanging over the precipice or facing a crisis. And this tour, and what you were saying is, let's anticipate some of these problems and deal with them first. But that seems so counter, Robert Bixby, to the way we deal with problems in this country.
It seems downright un-American.
It sure does.
Well, look, I think that One of the lessons to be learned from what's going on now with Wall Street is it's a lot easier and better to deal with something before it becomes a crisis when you know you have a problem. Now, we know we have a problem with these federal budget programs. We know that eventually it would lead to some sort of crisis. We don't know when or how. So maybe one of the lessons we can learn from the current financial crisis is that the federal government should begin to take some serious steps now to avoid a crisis of its own, because the federal government is strong enough now to come to the rescue of Wall Street. We don't want to wait and who's going to come to the rescue of the federal government if there's some sort of crisis. So I think maybe we can learn from the over-reliance on debt and the hiding obligations on the books that got Wall Street in trouble.
Well, and Alice Rivlin, I'm thinking about the drug benefit that was voted by Congress a couple of years ago. It turned out to be a lot more expensive, I think, than was originally projected. And it also, limited how older citizens, older Americans could get their drugs. But is that an example of where Congress helps to create this problem by providing this expensive benefit?
Yes, it is. And it's an example of something else. For 12 years, from 1990 to 2002, Congress imposed on itself some very strict rules about budgeting, and something called the PAYGO rule, for pay as you go. And that limited, by their own volition, what they could do. They could not, under the so-called PAYGO rules, pass either a tax cut or a benefit increase that wasn't paid for by an equal and offsetting program. So those rules expired in 2002 and were not reinstated. And that is one of the reasons we got the big drug benefit, because it couldn't have been paid for under the PAYGO rules, but it was allowed under the no rules of the period in which it was passed.
So bring back the PAYGO rule.
Bring back the PAYGO rule. PAYGO doesn't solve the whole problem, because it just keeps things from getting worse, but at least it does that.
Stuart Butler.
Let me just add that the drug benefit, I think, underscores also what I said earlier in terms of Congress only looking ahead a certain period and telling you that's what something costs. The debate over the drug benefit was that it would cost $400 billion, a lot of money, but $400 billion. What was really left unsaid for most ordinary Americans is, that was $400 billion over the first 10 years. It wasn't the full cost right out into the future. That, in today's dollars, if we'd had to borrow the money to pay all the stream of costs in the future, was $8 trillion. That was not discussed in any outside the sort of think tank world and maybe some staff on the Congress. But so people thought they were getting a pretty good deal, actually, when you look at it. But of course, it hid the long run effect. And I think that had we had a debate and said, well, we want to take on $8 trillion. By the way, at that time, that would have meant effectively doubling the national debt. Do you like this program? I think there'd probably been a rather different reaction than we actually saw.
And Robert Bixby, is the goal you know, no debt? I mean, or just a debt that's just much more manageable, closer to...
Debt in itself is not a bad thing. It's a good thing if you're investing. All of us do it. But debt, like other things, can be abused and overused. So we don't need to have a debtless government. What we need to have is a sustainable fiscal policy, one that you can look at out over a few decades and say, we know we'll be able to meet these obligations without taking on huge amounts of debt. And that's really the goal. And let's remember that part of what we're doing now is borrowing heavily from abroad. As Americans, we've stopped saving. And so when we're running these big budget deficits, our debt held by the public is now about 50% held by foreign nations. So we're becoming increasingly dependent on borrowing from abroad. And that presents certain vulnerabilities to us.
You want to add something to that, Alice Rivlin? Then I do want to get to our callers.
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. Let's get to the callers.
Okay, let's get to the callers. And that is Alice Rivlin, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, along with us, Robert Bixby, executive director of the Concord Coalition, and Stuart Butler, vice president for domestic and economic policy studies at the Heritage Foundation, all three of them part of the Fiscal Wake Up Tour. And for the last couple of years, they have been traveling the country, talking to people in various cities. In fact, here in Philadelphia, for a talk tonight at the University of Pennsylvania at 6 o'clock at Houston Hall, 3417 Spruce Street in West Philadelphia. Just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let's see what some of those callers have to say. And this is Mary from Springfield. Mary, go ahead, your Radio Times.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
It was my understanding that when Social Security was first started years ago, the government started borrowing from it and leaving IOUs, and if that's so, why not have the government pay back the IOUs and stop using it as their side kitty, and wouldn't that then make it solvent?
Mary, this has been discussed before. I guess I'm back to you, Alice Rivlin.
It's a little bit more complicated than that, but your idea is right. Social Security at the moment is running a surplus. That surplus will disappear as the baby boomers retire, but we do have a surplus now. And the government is running a deficit in the rest of the budget, which isn't exactly borrowed from Social Security, but the net of the two, the deficit in the rest of the budget and the surplus in the Social Security, are added. And so it makes the deficit look smaller than it really is. So in that sense, it's a sleight of hand. But they haven't actually taken money out of the Social Security trust fund. They have, and that trust fund, unfortunately, is not big enough to pay the benefits that are owed in the future as the baby boom generation retires.
We can go ahead.
Like I say, but let's be clear that, as the caller said, the surplus, the money that comes on into Social Security that is greater than the amount actually being paid in benefits in that year is not put away somewhere
in that lockbox, I remember.
Or a lockbox guarded by Marines or something like that. It is actually used to pay for other programs. So, yes, it's true that there's a surplus, but there isn't any cash available for the future. So when Alice says, you know, the money's in a sense there, it's there in the sense of an obligation on the federal government to pay these. But the government doesn't have the money.
Because the government is spending more than it takes anyway.
Alice? Right, but I think it's important not to scare people that they won't get their Social Security benefits. They will get them. They are firm obligations of the U.S. government. It's just that these obligations are larger than the funds that are available at the moment to pay them in the future.
Well, and they will require...
The other thing I want to add to that,
and this is Robert Bixby,
as a different perspective, is that Social Security doesn't have a long-term problem because the government has been raiding the trust fund. I think a lot of people have that. You really can't raid the trust fund. It's got IOUs in it. That's what it's supposed to have in it. We have a long-range problem because the promised benefits won't be paid for by the level of the payroll tax that we have now. So there's a gap that opens up in about 10 years, and whether we not – we have a trust fund, and regardless of what the government does with that trust fund, that same gap between benefits and the taxes exists, and that's really what we have to concentrate on in the future.
Let me get Mary. Thanks for the call. We've got Jim now from Burnville, Pennsylvania. Hi, Jim. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wonder whether this team is going to devote as much energy to warning us about the dangers inherent in our enormous military expenditures. As you know, we're spending more than the whole rest of the world put together, 700-odd bases around the world. And, you know, the notion is that we can afford to do things like that forever. And yet, when it comes to things like medical care, so often the prognosticators talk about how we really can't afford a national health program.
Well, Jim, let me take your call because it's a good one. It has to do with military spending. And let me toss that back to you, Robert Bixby.
It's an excellent question. We get it a lot. I think the defense is about 20% of the federal budget, which is about the same as Social Security. Here's the difference. Defense is not programmed to grow faster than the economy. In fact, during the 90s, it came down from about 6% of our economy to about 3% of the economy as the Cold War wound down. Now it's back up to about 4% of the economy. But as you look ahead, it will scale back operations at some point probably. But even if we maintain them now, it would probably just stay around 4% of the economy. So when you look at it that way, whereas the health care and Social Security programs will grow as a percentage of the economy, particularly the health care programs, so they create more of a problem as you look ahead.
Go ahead, Alice Rivlin.
That's true. But I think the caller is getting at something very important. What we would like to have happen is for people to say, what do we want the federal government to do? Health care, defense, how much of each, and how are we going to pay for it? And that's what we're not facing up to. We are running a very large defense budget, as the caller pointed out. In my opinion, we could do with less. But we aren't thinking about the relative magnitudes. How much do we want to spend for defense and how much for health? And let's pay for both of them at the level that we want.
Well, and this gets us to the Iraq War, Stuart Butler. We have about a minute before our second break here, but if the Iraq War has cost so far $700 to $800 billion and still counting, I mean, that does affect the debt/deficit.
Well, there's no question about it. Whatever you do on the defense side does. But it is important, I think, to recognize a very important difference between defense and, say, Medicare. In the defense, and the Iraq War is a good example, we have regular votes in Congress to decide whether or not to spend more money on the war and whether to spend. We have a defense bill each year. We do not have this with Medicare. Medicare, as we've all said, is on autopilot. It just keeps growing whether you do anything. And that's the difference. And that's why I think when we look at these priorities, as Jim said, if you favor more on health and less on defense, let's have this on a sort of level playing field. Let's have a real debate and a real budget in both of these and make some decisions. Right now, we don't. We decide a budget on defense. We don't really decide a budget on health care.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation and our callers. That's Stuart Butler, Vice President for Domestic and Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Also with us, Alice Rivlin, Senior Fellow, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, and Robert Bixby, Executive Director of the Concord Coalition, all members of the Fiscal Wake Up Tour. And we've got calls coming into 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art supports WHYY and brings outsider art inside this fall. The quilting tradition gets a modern twist in G's Bend, the architecture of the quilt, plus paintings and decorative arts in an exhibition featuring Thomas Chambers, and the museum's first retrospective of 20th century self-taught artist James Castle. G's Bend, Thomas Chambers and James Castle, now on view. Details at philomuseum.org. The Philadelphia Museum of Art. Look inside.
Next time on Day to Day, at 18, a poor Chinese girl leaves her farm for the city. 3 years later, she's a well-paid office worker.
Time passes differently in a place like Dongguan.
Success can come fast for young women in China, but it's far from easy.
It's a very free world. It's also very dishonest. These are the lessons that they're learning.
The lives of China's factory girls, next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY. I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. What happens to a city when one of its corporate pillars goes down? We'll look at Charlotte, North Carolina. Also, Pakistan at war on its border with Afghanistan and in a nuclear standoff with its other neighbor, India. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we're talking about the fiscal wake-up tour. And our guests have been touring the country to alert the public about the government's fiscal policies, which they say are becoming unsustainable. They warn that ignoring the problem could have disastrous consequences for future generations. And they say that while there are no easy solutions, there are things that can be done. And that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times. 1-888-477-9499. Let me toss this to you, Stuart Butler. What about government waste, fraud, and abuse? And John McCain talks about earmarks. I think mm-hmm. that's $18 billion out of the federal budget. But if the government were to take a more serious look at things like waste, fraud, and abuse, would that help to rein in some of the spending and deal with the debt/deficit we've been talking about?
Well, certainly everybody's in favor of trying to remove waste and fraud. There's no arguing about that. But as you pointed out, just in terms of the numbers we're talking about, whilst it clearly would be better for the country if we did that, it really would make very little difference at all to the long-run picture. It's almost the thickness of the line when you start doing these long-term projections. It doesn't mean we shouldn't do it, but I think it's not an easy answer. Americans tend to understandably want simple answers. Can't we just do that or get out of Iraq or something like this? And we all agree that you can't. There's a fundamental sort of breakdown in our long-term financing here, and we've got to fix that, and we can't just do that by these small things, even though they're good steps.
And Alice Rivlin, and then we'll get back to our callers, what impact does it have that Americans are not saving either, and Americans are also trillions of dollars in debt when you add up all the debt, the credit card debt that people have. How does that figure into the kind of wake-up tour, fiscal wake-up tour you've been talking about?
Well, I think it's part of the same phenomenon. Americans have lived on borrowed money for a very long time. We have maxed out on our credit cards, gotten more credit cards, and this housing bubble was in part fueled by people buying bigger and bigger houses with bigger and bigger mortgages. Now, they were encouraged to do that by the people who were selling those mortgages, but it's all part of the same phenomenon. We have been living beyond our means, individually and collectively, for a very long time. And the financial crisis that we're dealing with at the moment is a crisis of over-borrowing, of over-leveraging, as they say, both by financial institutions and by individuals.
Let me get Kenneth from Clementon to join us. Kenneth, go ahead, your Radio Times.
Good day.
Good day.
The folks have just alluded to my question here. I'm concerned about the political persuasion of no new taxes, no new taxes. We can borrow money from almost anywhere in the world, but we can't pay taxes. And it used to be an honorable thing that citizens did to pay their taxes. And now it's some kind of evil mantra. No, you know, you don't want to pay your taxes. Don't give me any new taxes. I just want to be left alone, and taxes don't do anything for me. So how are we going to change that perception? And when are the politicians going to get real and stop saying that? And what we have to do is we have to pay as we go.
Well, you know, Kenneth, yeah, hold on 1 second because it's an important point. I'm going to toss that over to you, Robert Bixby. I mean, he wants to know how you can change the negative attitude, or attitude, as we say in Philadelphia, towards taxes.
Oh, Americans have had a negative attitude. I come from Boston. We threw the tea into the harbor a long time ago. So we're a fairly low-taxed country, you know, compared to European levels. I think, really, I don't like the no new taxes pledge myself. I personally think that taxes were cut recently, you know, more than we could afford to, but that's, you know, that's a judgment that people will look at differently. I think the key is that if you're going to keep taxes low, which is good for the economy over the long run, you have to keep spending low. And what we have lost track of here is that if the government spends, eventually that has to be paid for. It can be paid for by debt, which is what we're doing in the short term, or by higher taxes in the long term, but there's no free lunch.
And it seems that whenever there's a hurricane, people want the government to help, you know, with rescue efforts, but don't think that the government has much control or influence over their lives. Alice, really?
Not to mention a hurricane in the financial system where everybody wants the government to jump in. I think one solution may be to tie taxes more directly to the spending that they finance. And that might happen, say, in healthcare. If we decide we need to spend more on healthcare, and that's a decision, then we might tie it to a dedicated tax, a tax for healthcare. Then people know, I'm paying this, I'm getting something.
And the idea that while this may cost me, I'm going to get something in return.
Right. And people have lost the sense of connection, as the caller said, between the taxes they pay and what they get for it.
Looks like you want to add
Yes, I think one of the things we find over and over again, as Alice said, is that Americans are much more inclined to accept a tax that's related to a specific service than they are the general idea of tax. And that's partly because they don't trust the government to use those taxes for what they're intended. It's all part of that. But I do think this whole debate over taxes and spending, for that matter, kind of just illustrates the importance of having a much more honest national discussion about where we want to go. Because as Alice said, we could say, well, let's have a dedicated tax for health care. But are we going to do that on the basis of health care as a proportion of our economy, moving from 16% today to 25% within the next 10 or 15 years to maybe over 30%? Or do we say, well, wait a minute, let's look at the spending side as well? And I think it's incumbent on everybody who puts forward a proposal, whether on taxes to go up or to go down, to say, as Bob said, well, what are you going to say on the spending side? And
sure.
How are you going to get this to actually match together? That's much more important. I am not in favor of new and continuous increases in taxes. But on the other hand, I'm in favor of putting forward actual proposals to say, well, what would Medicare look like? And I think also if you look at something like Medicare, to say, well, right now, if you take part in Part B, that's the physician payment, you're paying basically 25 cents on the dollar or 50 cents on the dollar. And on Part D, the prescription drug benefit, well, that's about 25% of what it actually costs. Maybe rather than a tax, we say, well, why don't we increase the premiums on those that can afford it to the full cost of that, and let them then decide.
Like the Warren Buffetts of the world.
Let them decide whether they want that or not. Because I suspect that if you said to a lot of people who think that the drug benefit is the wonderful, most wonderful thing ever created by the federal government, if they had to pay four times as much for it, they might say, well, maybe I don't necessarily need quite as much and so on. Maybe we should cut this down a bit. But right now it's a deal you can't believe. It's too good to be true, and it is, of course, too good to be true.
And just throwing something else out here that I learned in doing some homework for the show about this tax gap, that every year the IRS, there's about $300 billion that is not collected. People that owe taxes, but it's not collected. And Robert Bixby, I mean, doesn't solve the problem, but I think it's a piece of what we've been talking about here.
It's a very small piece, I think. There's always waste in the system that way. Just like there's waste in the government, there's going to be some bleeding out of the tax system. And, of course, efforts should be made, but there's a tension there because if the IRS really went after people more aggressively, then people would there'd be some pushback from that and say, you know, these people are evil government agents raiding my business or something. Because a lot of that tax leakage comes from small businesses, self-employed, self-reporting. So there are trade-offs there. I think that there are ways that you can look at, can we get more revenue without necessarily raising rates? And there are certainly ways you can do that. And there are a lot of tax expenditures that we talk about, tax breaks that could be re-looked at and pull in some more revenues that might be done in a more efficient way without raising rates. So there
Go ahead, Alice.
Yes. There are also ways to think about the question, can we get more health care without actually spending more? We do know that our system is very inefficient, mm-hmm. and Medicare could take the lead in improving that. They have not really done that, but they could refuse to pay for medical errors. They could insist on health information technology, which would improve the efficiency of the system if it was used right. And they could actually say, we're not going to pay for treatments that have no proven effectiveness.
And Americans could be healthier, I mean, have a more healthy lifestyle. I mean, wouldn't that help to reduce the
it would.
The cost as well? Let me get to Bruce from Center City, Philadelphia to join us. Hi, Bruce. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, I was just wondering, is the national debt, which I think if I understand it's right, it's somewhere around $10 trillion, something like that,
yep.
is that ever meant to be paid off? And if so, what would the repayment plan look like?
Well, and we touched on this earlier. Can I toss that to you, Welsh? I'll put that back to you, Robert Bixby.
No, you don't need to pay it off, but what you need to do is be able to make the payments. If you want to look at it like our national mortgage payments, it's okay so long as you can afford the debt. But if you can't afford the mortgage, then you're going to get in trouble.
And it's $10 trillion now. How much do we pay for the debt service today?
We spent about $240 billion last year on interest payments, which is quite a bit. I mean,
right.
It's about 9% of the budget, and it's frankly it was more than we spent on the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. So it's a very large sum of money. Mm-hmm. Already, and if you run bigger deficits, of course, it will go up.
15, 20, 25, or, you know.
Yeah, it can be quite a bit.
Let me get to Bruce, thanks for the call. We've got Vincent now from Center City, Philadelphia, joining us. Hi, Vincent. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, great program. Ms. Rivlin, you did a terrific job when you were on the Fed, and you continue to do great work when you come on forums like this. Ms. Rivlin, do you
Thank
think
you.
That the chairman of the Federal Reserve's term should be restricted to, say, two terms? Mr. Greenspan, I believe, was very responsible for creating this bubble. He refused to recognize the extent of the derivative problem. I had a chat with Lawrence Summers in 95 when he got back from Mexico. It was $20 trillion notional value then. We're up to $560 trillion notional value. We don't know who the counterparties are. We don't know where they are. He refused
Vincent, hold on. Hold 1 second. Only because we had a lot of callers. And your question is about whether there should be term limits for the Federal Reserve Chair. Let me get Alice Rivlin to respond to that. Thanks for call.
Actually, there are term limits. The chairman serves for 4 years and then has to be reappointed by the president. Greenspan had a very good reputation in that period and was reappointed by several presidents. So I don't think term limits are exactly the answer there. But now we have a new chairman who's trying to cope.
Trying to cope, as we all try to cope. Let me get John from Oklahoma to join us. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're in Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
You're
I was
welcome.
Just thinking, as I've been listening to your interesting program, very noble that that you folks are spending time going to Penn State tonight, et cetera. But surely you look at your schedules in 3 months or 6 months or 24 months out, you'll be on to other things. Perhaps, I'm just thinking from a management standpoint, as I have little kids myself, you know, looking out 3 decades, perhaps the solution would be, can there be a group of people, world-class thought leaders, who can focus on this issue for a number of decades. Having said that, while I happen to lean left, someone could have an answer on the right side, but President Clinton, who has obviously a tremendous skill set and the age on his side, a baby boomer himself, and what do you know, if there was someone like a Barack Obama, that perhaps one party should say, we're going to take this up as our issue all decades. Hey, American voters, if you stick with us, we'll stick with you and we'll address this problem.
I appreciate the call. Let me toss that over to you, Stuart Butler.
Well, I think there's a lot of interest and support for the idea of some body, some group, call it a commission of some kind, that really does focus on this issue, people mm-hmm. drawn from both parties and from not just from members of Congress, and that they should look at this and then their proposal should be put to an up or down vote, like we deal with treaties, for example. Mm-hmm. Well, you can't just micromanage it. And the reason for arguing for that, I think, as the caller was saying, really, is that We have to, I think, face the fact that our political process, our very democratic political process in a small d, is really not very well organized to deal with this kind of problem over the long haul. And therefore, it's a question of altering the dynamics of the way the political process works. And so the idea of a commission looking at a structure of restructuring these programs, I think, is a way forward. And maybe President Clinton certainly has some skills along those lines, and there are others as well, I think, that could do that. And as part of that, I think you've got to go outside of Washington and talk to the American people about what these options are. I think a backdoor, backroom sort of commission is not the right way to do it. It's got to be upfront. The facts have got to be laid out, as we are trying to do, but with the full authority of the government and a commission saying, we really want to consult with you about these long-term options and what you feel about them.
And I'm looking at the clock here, but is it possible? I mean, this is a more philosophical question, Robert Bixby, but can we change the political process so that we act in a more responsible way, thinking long term?
Well, I certainly hope so. It's an unprecedented challenge, as we were talking about. One of the things that we're doing with the Fiscal Wake Up Tour is concentrating on younger people, which is why we're at UPenn, which is why we do all of our events, really, whenever we go to a city, go to a college, to have a forum, because this is a problem that they're going to be dealing with. The next generation of leaders is going to be dealing with, no matter what discipline they're interested in. This money crunch is going to be important. And so we're trying to plant seeds and form groups at the University of Pennsylvania. We're forming something called the Fiscal Stewardship Committee that's got members of the community, and this is a new initiative. So we don't just come into a city and leave, but try to leave a group behind that will keep the momentum going.
I'm giving you the last word, Alice Riffle.
Another thing we could do is change the budget process. The Congress would have to do this itself, but be convinced to, so that it really did look at the long-run obligations periodically and decide, what do we want to do and how do we want to pay for it? A way of forcing a vote, as we pointed out, some of the big programs that are growing fastest are outside the budget process. We should have a budget process that forces decisions on everything.
On that note, I thank all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Alice Rivlin, Stuart Butler, and Robert Bixby, part of the Fiscal Wake Up Tour in Philadelphia for an event at the University of Pennsylvania, 6 o'clock this evening in Houston Hall. That's 3417 Spruce Street in West Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. Find out more about the program, and you can leave us a message and also learn about our podcast. Peter Woodall helping us out today on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. And do